We'll bring the Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources and Policy and Finance Committee to order. We do have a quorum. Representative Hancock, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Mr. Chair, I have, and we've moved the minutes of March 20th.
Representative Hancock moved the minutes from yesterday, March 20th. All in favor of those, that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails, and minutes are adopted. Representative Vogel. Members, we have one, two, three, four bills to get through today. Representative Beard is not here yet. We'll try to get through as many of these as we can today. Hopefully we'll get them all done. Have a little better luck than we did yesterday. Representative Vogel, please. I will move a House File 2226. Be recommended passed and be placed on the General Register. Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. And I have a testifier with me, Tom Peterson from the Farmers Union. He's going to share a little bit about what we're looking to do and simply extending the date here.
Mr. Peterson, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Minnesota Farmers Union. Here today to testify in support of House File 2226 that simply extends the effective date to June 1st, 2017 for what I call the use it or lose it provision on wind easements. Under the current law, wind easement agreement with a landowner, many times a farmer, terminates if the easement holder does not begin commercial production of a wind operation within 7 years. Farmers Union successfully sought this legislation several years ago after concerns our members had about signing 25, 50, or even perpetual easements with energy companies and then have nothing happen. Members have also had concerns about sourcing easements for smaller wind projects, and a lot of acres had been locked up for a long period of time with no project in sight. We've also had members encounter issues with bankers regarding the length of the easements. We feel this provision has been working very well for both landowners and wind developers, and we urge you to extend the sunset, which is what this legislation does. I would also add, Chris Raddatz from the Farm Bureau asked me to let you know that they strongly also support this legislation. This bill is cleared to Energy and Agriculture Committees in the Senate, is on the consent calendar, and also included in the omnibus agriculture bill. Thank you.
Questions? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of a question on process. I think last summer there was an energy subcommittee created, and yesterday we had a bunch of energy bills, and today we do. So how come these energy bills aren't being heard in the energy subcommittee?
Representative Hanson, we're up against deadlines. Rather than go through two steps, we just thought we'd have one step and do it in the full committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the Energy Subcommittee have a budget?
Representative Hanson, yes.
And how many times has the Energy Subcommittee met?
Representative Hanson, one time as the subcommittee.
And Mr. Chair, I think there's a Legislative Energy Commission that, by being chair of the Energy Subcommittee, you're also the chair of the Legislative Energy Commission, is that correct?
Representative Hanson, that is correct. I'm co-chair with Representative Rosen on the Energy Commission, Legislative Energy Commission.
And Mr. Chair, I'm not often involved in these energy issues, so do these bills have to go to that Energy Commission, or do they provide any input, or has that commission met?
Representative Hanson, I believe the commission has met once, and these bills do not need to go through the commission.
This is helpful, Mr. Chair. And on that commission, do they have a budget or to do things, or do they have a budget?
Representative Hanson, yes, they do.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, you remember when this came through previously, and I think it sailed through with pretty broad support. And just, is there anybody opposed to this?
Peterson?
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of.
Any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 2226 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. And there were no amendments? No amendments. All those in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion prevails. The bill is passed and placed on the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Representative Murphy. Murray. Representative Murray, I will move House File 2747. Be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. Is that where you want it to go, Representative Murray?
Yes, Murray? Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Murray.
Mr. Chairman, members, good morning. Thank you for having us here today. I have with me also Steve Thomek from Basin Energy and Kenrick Cheevil from Dairyland Power. House File 2747, Dairyland and Basin are seeking opportunities to streamline the regulatory filings that they have to do in Minnesota. Dairyland and Basin staff report that they spend considerably more time on Minnesota's regulatory filing than they do on all other states in their service territory combined. Dairyland serves 25 co-ops in 4 states, and Basin serves 134 co-ops in 9 states. The IRP has become increasingly time-consuming and confrontational in recent years, in spite of the fact that it is an advisory-only report for non-regulated utilities like electrical co-ops. Dairyland and Basin are seeking help on this, and I think it's a reasonable request, especially in fact that in light of the statutory directive that the commissioner is to try to minimize unnecessary duplication in this reporting. With that, I will turn it over to my testifiers, and they can tell you a little bit more about it.
Very good. Who'd like to go first? Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. For your record, my name is Steve Thomek. I am the senior government relations representative of Basin Electric Power Cooperative. Basin Electric is based in Bismarck, North Dakota. As Representative Murray said, we provide electricity to 134 rural electric co-ops in 9 states. 12 of those co-ops are located in Minnesota. Co-ops are unique organizations in that we are not-for-profit, and our mission statements generally state that our purpose is to provide reliable, affordable electricity to our members. We have a service motive and are governed by the members we serve. And Minnesota has recognized this in a couple different ways. One, they've deferred the rate setting to our locally elected cooperative boards. Excuse me, and also most notably for this legislation, Mr. Chairman, the filing of our IRP, our Integrated Resource Plan, is advisory only. Just as a precursor, the IRP process is really developed for rate-regulated utilities. It is the rigorous analysis of additional generation resources to find the least cost resource. However, because co-ops are not rate regulated, the only reason for co-ops to even submit an IRP is for an overview of resource planning. And unfortunately for co-ops, the IRP has over the years suffered from a regulatory creep and now goes far beyond simply determining the resource planning. As I stated in the beginning, Basin Electric provides power to 12 distribution co-ops in Minnesota. In 2010, Basin Electric accounted for about 1.6% of the total retail sales in Minnesota, which is well within the margin of error of any assessment of statewide reliability. From Basin's perspective, this represents under 5% of our total sales across the 134 co-ops we serve. Yet our staff spends more time completing the Minnesota IRP than we do all other 8 states combined. In the past, DER staff has requested detailed information from all 134 member co-ops, including those as far away as New Mexico and Colorado. We contend that the operations of those faraway co-ops have no effect on the reliability of the Minnesota grid. As I mentioned earlier, there's currently an exemption from the IRP in place for utilities with a small presence in Minnesota. All this legislation does is simply extend those exemptions to reflect the current changes in the market in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Please speak your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kenrick Scable. I am the Senior Government Relations Representative at Dairyland. a generation and transmission cooperative headquartered in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We serve 25 distribution co-ops in four states. Three of those cooperatives are located in southeastern Minnesota. Members, you have my full testimony in your packet. I'll be giving you an abridged version in the interest of time for the committee. Current law provides an exemption from the requirement to file an integrated resource plan for utilities with a limited presence in Minnesota. The bill before you would modify that exemption criteria such that it would apply to Darrow and the Basin, who share common circumstances. We're both cooperative G&Ts in which most of our service territory is in states other than Minnesota. Electricity sales from our respective distribution cooperatives are less than 2% or 5% of Minnesota total electric sales. Our internal staff responsible for regulatory filings spend more time on Minnesota regulatory filings than they do on filings for all other states in our systems combined. The scope of the IRP filing and, of course, the cost to comply has grown dramatically for Darrowland in the last 10 years. In 2000, our filing was roughly approximately 50 pages. Our most recent filing submitted in 2011 was 4,324 pages with additional information requested. Folks, this is a document literally over 2 feet high. The IRP filing appears to have evolved from a snapshot in time review of resources planned for the future into a full-blown certificate of need type analysis. For non-rate regulated utilities especially, we would suggest that this is excessive for an advisory-only filing. In conclusion, we would suggest that modifying the current exemption to include Darrowland and Basin from the IRP filing would have no negative impact on the reliability of Minnesota's electric system for two reasons. One, as I interpret the statutes, we would still be required by statute to file a load and capability statistical report on an annual basis. Secondly, and Steve mentioned this earlier, our respective energy sales in Minnesota literally falls within the statistical margin of error for assessing the resource adequacy of the state as a whole. We believe the current exemption was designed to minimize the regulatory burden for utilities with a limited presence in Minnesota. What we're asking is that the exemption criteria be updated. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess there's kind of a set of rules we have in Minnesota that we expect utilities to follow that are located here, and understand that both of these organizations may not be located here and they may have minimal presence in Minnesota. But it seems to me that if you don't want to follow Minnesota rules, then why not we let somebody else take over that territory who is currently following those rules? If it's such a minimal amount and you're serving such a few number of customers, why not just allow somebody like Great River Energy or some other entities that is fully competent and capable of filling out these reports take over, because they don't have a problem doing it, so why shouldn't everybody have to play by the same rules?
But Mr. Chairman, Representative, I guess I would offer two responses to that. One, we do follow the rules. What we're asking is for an update of the exemption that is currently in law. It appears to be directed to impact those utilities with a limited presence. Secondly, our cooperatives literally sign 30-year non-compete clauses with the G&T they purchase their energy from. So this is not a simple matter of simply saying, we're not going to serve our customers anymore. We literally have long-term contracts. Those contracts allow us as a G&T then to seek financing when we need to make investments in our generation equipment, environmental upgrades, etc. Those are sales that we can, if you will, take to the bank.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, that seems a little bit troubling to me. I mean, I understand that a lot of these contracts are long-term in nature, but that doesn't necessarily give me comfort, because I mean, if that's a rationale for doing business the way it's been done and continuing to do it the way it's been done, it's not very forward-looking. And the energy resources that were available for the last 100 years are ones that future generations may not want or may not approve of the way things are being done. And so essentially, you're saying that, well, it's okay, let's go and allow whoever is going to live in these areas in the next 30 years be tied into what we believe right now to be an appropriate way of generating electricity. I've got some serious concerns with those long-term contracts because people today, people, the future generations, probably don't want to use the same resources. And I'm looking at this in the sense that maybe there's somebody else, some other utility that wants to be more progressive and is willing to offer those customers resources that they would find more appropriate moving forward. And so this information that we get that is for this resource planning, it helps us to understand a roadmap. And if these utilities don't want to participate in that, like I said before, I think we could find somebody who is willing to take on that service territory. So simply saying that because we want to maintain the status quo, whether it's through long-term contracts or using the same resources that we've used, I don't think that that's a good enough reason to go and offer this type of exemption. And I guess if the gentleman would offer another, I have another question. Let's take a look at some of the areas like North Dakota or South Dakota or neighboring states. Are the load requirements they have as intense as what we experience here in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Falk, I think what you're talking about is resource adequacy. And our concern about the current report isn't so much that we're opposed to filing a report in Minnesota. It's the depth and the length and the inquisition of the report that's of concerning concern to us. Again, our staff spends more time doing a Minnesota IRP than we do all the other states combined as they attempt to address their resource adequacy. This gets back to a real fundamental question from our perspective, is that we understand the concern that Minnesota may have. Do the utilities that serve Minnesota have enough resources to adequately serve our citizens? I think that's a fair question. We have to, as you pointed out, the electric system in our country has evolved over the last 70, 80 years, and it continues to evolve as well it should. As that evolves, we have gotten, we spend an enormous amount of time, much time, trying to make sure that we've got adequate insurances in place so that our system doesn't fail. And that is really oversaw today, which is developed in the last decade or so by NERC, and which is a federal entity which addresses this on more of a regional basis rather than a state basis. You also raise another interesting point about the timeliness of the reports, which I think is important as you consider this and what role the state of Minnesota wants to play in this. The timeliness of the reports is kind of an interesting part of this equation, if you will. Our staff spends about 6 months of the time prior to the submittal of the IRP. That means that our load forecast for the last year or two that we've developed in the last year is put into a document that the and we begin that process 6-7 months prior to the submittal of that. It takes the DER another 6-9 months, perhaps longer, to analyze that and submit that. My question was then is how reliable or what good information can the DER actually receive from this? Because by the time they get that and analyze that information, it's already outdated. What we suggest is that something on a more annual, more timely basis might better serve the needs of that rather than an in-depth analysis on something that probably is going to be useless 6 months after it's been submitted. So there's still the need for a reliability assessment within the process, but is the current process the correct one? And that's the questions we're raising.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I appreciate that information. I guess one of the questions I have in addition is that just because we ask a number of questions in Minnesota doesn't mean that we're not asking the right questions. And so to make the argument that just because what we do in Minnesota requires more time and effort is not necessarily a bad thing. It may be that the other states aren't asking enough questions. And so my question would be is if we are doing a much more comprehensive analysis, are other states looking at the reports filed in Minnesota to help base some of their judgments as far as resource planning going forward?
Mr. Chair, I'll try and take a shot at responding to that. Obviously, I'm a little reluctant to try and ascribe motives to what the other states are doing. I think a little historical perspective perhaps is helpful. My understanding is the IRP was started at a point in time following some controversial infrastructure projects in Minnesota. And the IRP was essentially put in place so that there would be some forewarning, if you will, given to the commission for projects planned in the future. So if there's a controversial transmission project or generation project, there would be advance notice of that. Over time, I think the IRP has evolved into more of a assessment for setting rates. In other words, make sure that you invest in the least cost resource, incorporating things as varied as carbon costs, etc. The other aspect that the department has told us that is their focus is resource adequacy. We report resource adequacy to a number of entities or other states as well as NERC-related agencies. I think really the time intensity resulted when the Division of Energy Resources began to try and duplicate those forecasts. Our forecast analyst literally co-op by co-op does a forecast analysis, and he aggregates those into a forecast for our entire system. He literally sits down with each manager and talks with them about what do you see happening in your co-op. Is a business coming in? Are they leaving? Are they growing? It literally gets down to including things as trivial as the light usage on Main Street in Barron, Wisconsin. It was when the division began demanding that we provide all of that information from all of those co-ops, and regardless of what state they existed in, so that they could duplicate our methodology. That's really when we perceived a great increase in the amount of time it took the division to analyze those. And as Steve mentioned, by the time we create the snapshot in time, give it to them, they're able to sufficiently analyze it. It's easily 12, sometimes 18 months from the point in time we created the submission. And by the time the information gets to the commissioners, it's obsolete. It's just obsolete. I've heard commissioners even raise that criticism at their meetings, that they wish they could get more timely information, statewide snapshot, as opposed to utility by utility spread out over a period of literally months and years.
Thank you for that, Mr. Chairman. Last question for these testifiers. What is this doing? What is the cost of preparing this report to the average consumer? How much on an annual basis does this cost typical person, typical consumer?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't broken that down on a consumer by consumer basis. Clearly, we spend probably 6 months of staff time preparing the report, additional time responding to it, and of course, you know, we're billed for the department's staff time in reviewing it. I believe, I think the last report we were billed like $20,000 for the department's review of our IRP. I don't have the number exactly.
So, couple cents a year, a couple bucks? I mean, how many? Okay.
Tomek?
I have really nothing to add, Mr. Chairman. Our cost is roughly what we pay the state of Minnesota to review our IRP, I believe, is somewhere in that $20,000 to $25,000 range area. I think the important point is this, is how much time does the DER want to spend on an IRP that's advisory only for 1.6% of the retail sales in Minnesota?
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to figure out how this works in a practical manner. Mr. Scavel, so let's say Dairyland has the Alma plant, coal plant along the river, and you sell the power to a Tri-County Electric Co-op, a distribution co-op. And the bill here says that 80% of its member distribution cooperatives. So does that mean 80% of the 25 member cooperatives or 80% of the aggregate membership of your cooperatives? I'm trying to look at, is it the number of cooperatives that you're taking the percentage of, or is it the number of customers within the cooperatives that you're taking the percentage of?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe the way the language is structured, it means that if, as a G&T, 80% of our cooperatives are located in other states, this exemption would apply. In addition, the other criteria would be that less than 5% of Minnesota's total energy sales comes from the energy produced by our system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hanson.
So how many actual cooperative members or how many consumers do you have in Minnesota? If both of you, do you know how many actual people, customers you have in Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's often a difficult number to ascertain from this vantage point, is part of those members are double counted. I think the point was made earlier that that perhaps we, let me start that over.
But Domek, just give us a rough guess. We don't need a complete explanation of how you figure it.
The brief explanation, Mr. Chairman, is that many of the members in Minnesota are double served. We serve some of the same co-ops that GRE also serve. We serve part of their load, GRE serves part of their load, and so many of these members are double counted. If we're going to count everyone and double count them, we're probably in that 30,000 population range.
Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, I think the testifier was going to answer. I know you sent him a note telling him to keep it short, but I did ask him a question and he was about to answer it.
I thought it was answered, Representative Hanson. Did you have something further to say, Ms. Gable?
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say I believe Dairyland serves slightly under 40,000 members in Minnesota.
I didn't mean to cut anybody off, Representative Hanson. I just thought they were done. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in regard to some of Representative Falk's comments, a couple things he mentioned was forward thinking and, you know, maybe you need to be more progressive. And I think this is an instance where maybe the DER needs to be more progressive. They've been doing the same thing for 30 years, the same thing only adding to your work that you're having to do. It seems to me that maybe we're placing the onus and the blame on someone, on the customer and not the department. My question is any of the data that you provide in the IRP given in any other reports that you have to file to the DER?
Mr. Chair, yes. I think the heart of the report is the statistical load and forecast information. As I mentioned in my testimony, even if we do not do the IRP, we are still required by statute to provide that statistical information to the department on an annual basis. Dairyland is a MISO member. We supply similar information to MISO. And as a matter of fact, we have had numerous talks with the division, seeing if there's a way we can streamline our reporting within current statutes We haven't come to agreement at this point, but we're continuing to talk with them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might quickly. So you have a 4,000-page report that you do, and is that would that be a bigger pile of papers for a company that has more customers in the state of Minnesota? Do you know the answer to that?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the bulk of that report is the statistical information from each one of our 25 cooperatives. So the more cooperatives that we serve, the taller that stack of information becomes. The heart of the report is still only about 50 pages, maybe 60, in terms of, if you will, the summary. The rest of it is all the co-op by co-op statistical information that allows the department to try and replicate our methodology.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, this won't be a question as much as a comment. Listening to discussion yesterday, I believe it was, and today, I'm a little taken aback at the cavalier attitude that we take towards additional costs. Incremental costs here, incremental costs there. You know, whether it's these IRPs and thousands of pages of reports and reasonable questions, I think, about just what they do and what costs they add, seem to be kind of blown off and given short shrift. Or the Renewable Development Fund, how much does that cost per customer? How much does the CIP cost per customer? How about the Renewable Energy Standard? How about any one of 100 things we ask these folks to do? A little here, a little there. And if it doesn't seem to be more than a dollar or so a month to a customer, we just act like that's nothing. And we forget to look at it in the aggregate. And we forget to look at the basics of what makes our economy work, and that's the productive and efficient use of resources. Some of those resources include the people that we make these reports. I heard 6 months mentioned here of staff time to compile a report, and I think we are asking to what end? How does Minnesota be a better place because we take 6 months of their staff time, not to mention just a couple pennies a customer, but the staff time. And then the staff time to read it. How many times have we read that 4,000-page report? I can't recall that I've ever even seen one. I know you file them. But there seems to be an underlying assumption that unless we bury you with regulations and paperwork, you're not going to take care of your customers. And oh, by the way, your customers are your owners, if I recall right. How much tighter of a relationship can we get? PUC commissioners have any more of a relationship with them than their own customers have, their own owners have, because your customers are your stockholders. And I have a hunch that they probably watch pennies a lot tighter than we do around here, given some of the loose comments that have been made the last couple days. There seems to be a complete disregard, and I won't take it as disrespect. I'll just take it as lack of knowledge, lack of experience in dealing with time and effort in the aggregate number. We're throwing some big numbers around here, folks. Wouldn't that be great if we could put that into, say, the LIHEAP program instead? But oh, wait, it's only a couple pennies a household, so it doesn't really count. Wouldn't it be great if maybe we could put that somewhere else, let you invest in some new technology or run some more efficient transformers? But oh, wait, it's only a couple pennies. And you know, that couple pennies a household can be turned around and used the other way, members. If we say, oh, we won't make them make that investment because it only drives costs up a couple pennies a household, that can cut both ways. But I want you to know that at the end of the day, there are basic economic laws and we should be following, and principles we should be following here, as well as the environmental rules that we profess interest in. And members, these folks have been around for a lot longer than we have, trying to do the best job with the use of the time and the resources they have, which includes the employee time, not just the ratepayers' dollars, and the other assets that they have to deploy to take care of their customers. And at the end of the day, those customers are going to hold them a lot more accountable than anybody at the Department of Commerce or the PUC will, particularly with the municipals and the cooperatives. So I just want to think about that as we go forward. It's just a penny here, a penny there. Pretty soon we're talking real money. More importantly, we're talking about a real drag in our economy.
I'm going to call on Representative Knuth, and then we're going to need to bring up the department and have them weigh in on the bill. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question maybe while the department can answer while they're up, because I'm hearing the difference between a 50-page report and a 4,000-page report, and I... seems like there's a lot of page numbers in between 50 and 4,000, and it seems to just get rid of an integrated resource plan completely. Seems like we might not get the information we need, but have you either the testifiers now or the department, when they come up, thought about finding some other way to make sure Minnesota gets the information, or is there some sort of position in the middle? And the reason I ask that is, it's, you know, we're talking around the edges of the energy system, but, you know, small things in the grid can cause big problems. And, you know, we talk less than 5% of the electricity annually sold at retail in the state of Minnesota. You know, if you have enough of those, you can add up to a fairly large amount of electricity sold in Minnesota. And so I'm just, is there a way other than, rather than just completely getting rid of an integrated resource plan, and maybe there already is another way. I'd just like some commentary about figuring some way to get this information, which I do think is important for making sure that our electricity system and our grid works for the state of Minnesota as a whole, but not making unnecessary reporting happen at the co-op level.
Ms. Gable.
Mr. Chair, thank you for those questions, Representative New. Two responses. One, we have been in conversations with the department trying to find some way of streamlining the current regulatory process. So we have been working on trying to find something other than a full exemption. Secondly, Minnesota is the only state in the Midwest I'm aware of that uses the integrated resource plan approach. The other states are quite comfortable taking the aggregate numbers utilities submit to them, as well as to federal agencies, on face value and analyzing from there.
Thank you. And why don't we bring up the department at this time, and I think they might want to weigh in on that too, and I think Representative Knuth wants them to discuss that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, Peter Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce. Perhaps just to Representative Knuth's question first. Representative, a couple of quick points. In reference to the page number conversation, first. There is no set form in which a utility files their IRP. And so 4,000-page number that has been referenced is specific to Dairyland. It's not representative of adding more and more workload the larger your utility becomes. For example, Xcel Energy, the largest utility in the state, their last integrated resource plan filing was a couple hundred pages. Our comments are traditionally somewhere in the neighborhood of 50. It's up to the utility to decide how they want to file. Now, that said, I'd like to echo Mr. Scable's comments and thank him and Mr. Tomac and their organizations. We have been engaged in a conversation with both of their organizations that's been going on for some time here to try to find a way that reduces workload on their part and reduces workload on the department's part and still allows us to fulfill our mission. Those conversations have been going well, and they've been in good faith, and we continue to have them. Those conversations presuppose, though, that the department is still able to do the work that we are required to do under Minnesota law to ensure that we have a reliable electrical system in the state. And it's the department's position that as it's written right now, the bill before you would prevent us from doing so. So that said, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to thank Representative Murray for bringing the bill forward, because it does highlight an opportunity for us to talk about resource planning, which are critical tools that help the state ensure that we have reliable electricity and that their electricity is reasonably priced. It's important to ensure that all electric utilities, regardless of their size, have adequate resources to serve their customers because our system is integrated. Regardless of the size of a utility, if one utility fails to provide adequate resources on their system, that can have an effect on every other utility in the state and all of those utilities' customers. So, for example, a failure on Dairyland's part to provide adequate resources on their system would not be isolated to just the 40,000 customers and businesses that they serve in Minnesota. That could have an effect on the entire integrated system as a whole. So, it's not just a matter of how big a size of a footprint that utility has in the state, it's the integrated nature of the entire system as a whole that becomes the issue. We have been engaged in these conversations on an ongoing basis, as I've said. The two utilities first approached us in October. We first got some information from them beginning in January, and we've been going back and forth and having a very good conversation about what other entities, both Basin and Dairyland, provide this type of information to. And we have now been meeting with those entities to understand what they receive and how they use it and how they have confidence in those numbers. This is something that is going to take a little bit of time and has taken a little bit of time, in particular in Basin's case, because we do not have a pre-existing relationship with the entity that they report to. And so we've been developing those relationships, and again, I'd like to thank them for their willingness to engage with us on that. So I think, Mr. Chair, the department at this time would respectfully ask that this bill perhaps be laid over so we could continue to have those conversations and see if we can arrive at a point where we can find a way to adjust the filing in a way that reduces workload for the utilities and for the department and allows us to continue to fulfill our mission. We would see that as a win-win for all parties involved. So thank you. And I'd stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Representative Beard. I'm sorry, Representative Beard. You're not next. Representative Paul. Okay, Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickwell, you stated that it's up to the utility to decide how to do the reports, and to me, the additional pages seem to be to trace and verify methodology. Has the department had an issue with the methodology, and therefore you're pushing the utility to provide all of these extra pages of data?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't think that's necessarily the case, and in depending on which utility it is, we sometimes have different follow-up questions based on what they initially provide to us. I think the object of the resource plan is to ensure that we have reliability in the system. And to that end, having some measure of confidence in that we are not just getting the final answer, but we're also getting the work that shows how we arrived at the final answer is important. And that to that end, in the event that there are questions about some of the answers or some of the work, that can result in additional requirements, but that would happen on a one-off basis with each individual utility as they file their plans. Just one quick note about Dairyland in particular, because they've just recently filed their most recent IRP. They filed their IRP in November. We filed our comments in February, which did include an update of circumstances that had occurred between November and February.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what I'm hearing is, you know, confusing me in that unless the department found some issue with their methodology, that the utility wouldn't have to file more than 50 pages. So is there some issue with methodology, or is this you know, just bureaucracy forcing on undue activity to a, you know, captive, you know, utilities are extremely constrained. So I'm trying to understand why you say it varies by utility, but if a utility has proven its methodology, you know, unless you question that they've changed something, then I don't see why you're continuing to increase the burden, because that reviewing the history, it appears as if there's been an increase in burden. So what is the justification, be it one utility or all utilities, for increasing the burden if there's no issue? And if there's an issue, you know, can you state notification of the issue? And, you know, I'm just trying to understand, because it seems, you know, I don't have any direct or indirect investment in any of the power utilities, so I might not be familiar with, you know, why you would cause this additional burden upon them.
Mr. Chair and Representative, certainly didn't intend to be confusing. The main issues that we look at in an IRP are whether a utility has enough resources to meet the needs of their system and whether or not their plan complies with Minnesota law. And when I say that it varies from utility to utility, what I mean by that is different utilities provide different types of looks at their methodology. Or different, you know, some utilities may just say, here's the whole thing right off the bat. Other utilities may not want to give us information that we initially request, but we have a back and forth dialogue between the two utilities who just testified. They file in different ways. And so that tends to be where there is a slight difference between utilities in terms of how they file and how they respond to our questions. That is to say that I don't think that we have necessarily increase the burden, but there does end up to be an elongation of the process sometimes when we are asking for different types of information and the utilities want to provide it in different forms, and we go back and forth about whether or not the data that they're providing us allows us to fulfill our mission. And that is, to that end, part of what the discussion is right now with both Basin and Dairyland, which is to sort of try to figure out what is the answer to that very question, which is what are the ways that we can have confidence in the data that they are providing to us or to another entity that's regulated at the NERC level in order for us to have confidence in those numbers.
Representative Quam, we've got quite a number of people that want to testify or have questions yet. We've got two more bills to do in the next 45 minutes, so Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One last question. How many years I would think that you'd get the hang of this communication. How many years have you been requiring this report?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but I can certainly provide it for you probably by the end of the year.
Sounds good. Representative Beard.
Pass.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Quick question. To the testifier, you mentioned that a hiccup in the system of Dairyland or Basin Electric could affect Minnesota's grid system. But isn't it true that being we have a regional system or really a national system, that a hiccup in Indiana or Canada could also affect Minnesota's system? Is that true?
Reply.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, potentially so. The only entity looking at Minnesota-specific information is the department, and the Public Utilities Commission looks at Minnesota resources. And to that end, as you've heard both Basin and Dairyland testify, and myself, we are having conversations about the other regional and national entities that they file reliability information to, and we are in conversations with those organizations to try to understand what data they receive, how they use it, how they have confidence in those numbers, and if there is an opportunity, or if it's very similar to how we use it here, I think we will be having ongoing conversations with the utilities about how we can reduce that workload and kind of streamline that process.
Representative Presbo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I was going to ask some more questions about what happens in other states, and I'd like to maybe talk to Mr. Scavel later about that, but it seems curious to me that other states seem to be able to manage their understanding of their resources in an adequate way without having to submit 4,000 pages to the bureaucracy, I find it unacceptable to hear from the department that, oh, Xcel Energy only has to submit, oh, just a couple hundred pages. That is still, Mr. Brickwetty, way too much. You're on the front end right here of government killing jobs. That's what's going on here. And we've got to find a better way to do things. This bill aims to exempt something that's in the margin of error of our overall resources. We got to bring some common sense back to the way things operate here. Representative Fox says, you know, if you don't like it, take your marbles and go home and somebody else will do it. That is perfectly illustrative of the problem we're having here. That is why jobs are leaving Minnesota.
and we have to turn the ship around. I look forward to supporting the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, well, the department asked for more time to work on this, and I know Representative Drazkowski just said he had some additional questions, and I think there were some other members that had questions but decided not to ask them. So I would move to refer this back to the Energy Subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
Representative Hansen moves that the bill be referred down to the Energy Subcommittee, and Representative McNamara requests a roll call. The clerk will call the roll, and the chair will vote no. Question.
On my motion, Mr. Chair, I see this bill was introduced March 8th. The author and the department would have had a couple weeks to work on this. The Energy Subcommittee could have met. The subcommittee that was created last year to deal with energy issues, but has only met once, but does have a budget. So I know that the chair of the full committee has directed interests to go take things and work them out. Well, this could have been worked out over the last 2 weeks, but it wasn't. So here we are racing up against deadline, pushing to get it done, and that's what subcommittees are for. Could have gone through all these questions, could have brought it here, could have sailed through, but that didn't happen, so let's send it.
Clerk, call the roll. The chair votes no.
McNamara?
No.
Anderson?
No.
Beard?
Nay.
Dill?
Yes.
Drazkowski?
No.
Fabian?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hancock?
No.
Hansen?
Yes.
Hilty? Knuth?
Yes.
Purcell? Quam?
Yeah.
Scott?
No.
Torkelson?
No.
Wagenius?
Yes.
There being 5 ayes and 10 noes, the motion does not prevail. Representative McNamara.
No.
Oh, okay, Representative McNamara. Okay, I'll renew my motion that House File 2740. Oh, Representative Falk.
Are we going to have final discussion to the bill? Is that what we're on right now?
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I know there's been some comments run around here about lack of knowledge, or else, you know, so-and-so will take their marbles and go home. I think we have to be careful too, because we could talk about lack of knowledge, but also lack of knowledge of history. And why do we have integrated resource planning in the state of Minnesota? And that's because it came out of the gross overbuilding, the gross abuses that ratepayers were forced to pay because nobody was checking whether or not assets and infrastructure were necessary, needed, used, or useful for ratepayers. And so if we want to go down that pathway of talking about a lack of knowledge, we have this process in place to protect consumers. And yes, it does cost resources, but in order to make informed decisions, we have to pay for that knowledge. And when we look at, if we want to go and make this more efficient, if we want to go and save some resources, let's take a look at the fact that, okay, this is 1.6% of total sales in the state of Minnesota. If we have utilities in the state that are already filing these resource plans, that are fully able and capable of doing it, that are not asking for special treatment, then maybe they're the ones that should be taking on these service territories. And if there is massive savings to be realized, we could put those dollars into conservation and efficiency, LIHEAP, we could put them into any number of areas. But I have yet to see a quantifiable amount of money that this would save. And this is just asking for special treatment because one entity or one utility doesn't want to have to follow the same rules as the others. And so we've put these rules in place to protect consumers. And let's go and be very clear, too, that when there were abuses taking place, what necessitated integrated resource planning, it was not always for resources being constructed in the state of Minnesota. It was for resources being constructed outside of the state's borders by utilities that served some proportionality of their customers in Minnesota. That's the history. So if you want to talk about lack of knowledge, let's talk about lack of knowledge of history.
Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a question for the author. It sounds like the department's been trying to work with these utilities, and it sounds like there's a good faith effort, and moving the bill forward and skipping the energy subcommittee, and I think where we could have had a more thorough discussion about this. It seems like an impetus for discussion is there, and I'd like to, force that to continue, so to speak. And I'm just curious if the author would be willing to put a sunset on this, because it is a pretty significant change just to not have this information provided to the department, and the PUC and the department not having the information they need to make sure Minnesota's electricity system is working well. And a sunset, I think, would light a fire under the but the need for negotiation, perhaps find some sort of reasonable outcome, and maybe that'll happen before this bill gets to the floor, some sort of outcome that would work for both the department and the these cooperatives. But I'm not going to amend it here, but I'm going to hope the department and these cooperatives continue to work, and perhaps on the House floor be looking at offering a sunset to this provision.
Professor Murray.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time today. I think everything has been said that needs to be said. We're simply looking for reasonableness in reporting. Thank you.
And I'm sure you're going to be working with the department to make any changes.
Very much intend to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Chair will renew his motion that House File 2747 be recommended pass and be placed on the general register. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed and placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Murray. We had a great discussion on that bill. Representative Beard. Representative Beard moves House File, or Senate File 1788 be recommended pass and I believe placed on the general register. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you for the motion, and thank you for your attention to this matter as the full committee. Thank you for economizing on our time not making
Representative Beard, Senate File 1788 has passed all the committees in the Senate and passed the Senate.
Thank you for that information. I appreciate it. The we're going to hear it in the Energy Committee, then bring it back here again for further discussion. I appreciate the economy of just hearing it here this one time. Mr. Chairman and members, it's been a fascinating discussion this morning. I'm sorry I missed the first few minutes of it, but I'm struggling on 3 hours of sleep. I used to be able to do that when I was 30, not so much anymore. But thanks to the good coffee and the stimulating discussion, I think I'm fully awake and ready to engage in a little bit of discussion about Senate File 1788. First of all, a little background. There has been some comments about the history of electrical generation, distribution, and sales in this country. In the interim, Dr. Robert Bradley from, I think it was Wyman and Sons, I'll get you the name of it, because every member of this committee should read the book called Edison to Enron. It is a fascinating discussion of the electrical energy industry in this country and how we got to where we are. Representative Falk referred a little bit to it. I would suggest that it's a little inaccurate, because although there was the history of overbuilding, the ratepayers, and for the large part, did not take it on the financial chin. The bondholders did, and that's an important distinction to remember. Overbuilding and competition, the electrical industry brought rates down phenomenally from the time the first dynamos were introduced, cranking out DC power in Chicago and other places, the great market contest that finally settled on AC power, and 60 cycles and all that other stuff. It's all in the book. You can read the book. It is a great read. Heavily footnoted, heavily documented. But the underscoring point I want to make here today, it was not the market that created this. It was political capitalism that created what we have today, with service territories, monopolies, and a regulated industry. And that was basically the capitalists that demanded that, members. It was basically the people who put up the money to build the infrastructure that said, we can do this more efficiently in a safer environment if the government would just protect us from competition. Now, the regulators did a fine job of holding the line on prices because there was some other competition going on at the time. Nonetheless, just by way of overarching discussion here this morning, Edison to Enron by Robert Bradley is the book. Wiley and Sons is the publisher. It just came to me. You should all get that book and read it. It is a fascinating book. I'd recommend his first book, too, Political Capitalism at Work. That's also an interesting discussion of economics, politics, business, capitalism, and there's so much to love and know about this fascinating industry. Mr. Chairman, the preceding bill also covered a lot of the waterfront of what I was going to talk about here this morning and about Senate File 1788's proposal to have a once-a-decade study from the PUC on all the rules and regulations that are out there, because the member that made the comment earlier is exactly correct. Things change quickly in this industry. Things that maybe the last legislature, the last generation wanted to know probably aren't relevant today. There's a good chance that might be. I would also add that we should not be so arrogant as to things that we demand today are going to be needed to know in another 10 or 20 years, and we should not be so arrogant as to presuppose that we have the answers to the kind of energy sources our kids and our grandkids are going to be working with. Mr. Chairman, I think there's people out there far brighter and more ambitious than we are. They're always looking for a better mousetrap, and thank goodness that still works in the United States of America, because it keeps us on the cutting edge of prosperity and so on and so forth. This was supposed to be a simple bill to start the discussion at PUC and with the electric utilities, actually all of them, over the interim to have discussions like we just had here over the last hour. It was asking the utilities and the PUC to sit down and talk about where there is waste in the system. If indeed a 4,000-page report is overkill, perhaps PUC could instruct the utility how to make that a 50-page report or even a 400-page report. Hey, we'll cut them some slack. It doesn't change any of the state's energy policies or any other mandates or goals that we love to argue about around this place. None of that at all. Just the reports and just the reporting requirements. That's all Senate File 1788 did or is designed to do. It's a platform for utilities and agency staff to come together and determine what information is actually necessary, what actually amounts to good record records for compliance, for knowing what's going to happen in the future. Perhaps what other agencies are already involved in this game that are duplicative. Perhaps they're even doing a better job. And members, I'd remind you that it is not just the PUC that regulates the utilities in this state. It's also the Attorney General and the Department of Commerce. There's a discussion we could have someday. Beyond that, though, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, known as FERC, also has a lot of oversight and drives a lot of what we do in this state. MISO, there's a word that never even came up this morning, the Midwest Independent System Operator. So whenever we hear professions that we're concerned about what happens just outside our borders, do you realize there's actually a group of very capable, talented people who already get together every day and have an enormous staff of very talented people, both in Bandana Square and in Mount Carmel, Illinois. All they do is watch dials and meters and make sure that every transmission line, every generating station, every major load center is accounted for in real time so that the system operates at maximum effectiveness and efficiency. They also act as a clearinghouse, so if somebody needs to take generation offline and buy something somewhere else, they take care of all the very complicated billing and credits and invoices and everything else that fly around that we don't have to talk about here this morning. It's just enough for this legislator to know that there are people who do that and do it very well. So I think it's a very reasonable discussion for us to have to say, why are we triplicating that process in Minnesota? Could we just do it one time, just duplicate it once, and do just as effectively? Well, that was to be the bill we were going to hear this morning, members. The Department of Commerce and the PUC, however, seem to take a very dim view of that, and the people who asked me to carry the bill and were going to testify this morning have actually asked me to pull the bill back. So we're not going to have that discussion, but I just wanted to tee it up, and I wanted you to know that we're thinking about it. I think some of the bill that Representative Murray just discussed with us probably gets at some of these issues. Mr. Chairman, you're also the co-chair of the Legislative Energy Commission. Perhaps in the interim, when things calm down a little bit and passions cool a little bit, we could visit this issue again. The Department of Commerce and the PUC have asked us if we could give them time to do this just over a cup of coffee with the utilities. Members, I'm a big fan of drinking coffee and chatting with people. We can work a lot of things out a little less confrontationally and probably a little more effectively if we do it over a coffee table somewhere at Perkins. With that, Mr. Chairman, I just ask that you lay this bill over, and perhaps we'll take this up again another time.
Very good. Senate File 1788 is laid over. The chair will move House File 2769, be recommended to pass, and be sent to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I will bring down Drew Maratska. Discuss the bill.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent, and you can explain our bill for us.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Drew Moratska. I'm attorney at Maple, Krauts & Moore and represent large industrial consumers of energy in the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Moratska, if you want to hold for a moment, it's the A2 amendment. I'd like to adopt the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I like, and that would be the same language that is in the Senate. Is that correct, Mr. Moratska?
It's very close to the same language, yes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Moratska. We'll vote on the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I like. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony today. As I mentioned, I do represent large industrial consumers. I do so before the Public Utilities Commission and intervene on their behalf in utility rate cases. Here today to discuss the cost-based rates legislation, which encourages job growth and improves low-income programs. Utilities, as we've learned through a lot of testimony today, are regulated entities. When they want to increase rates, they have to come before the Public Utilities Commission and ask for permission. As part of these requests, the utilities file what are called class cost of service studies. The purpose of these studies is to put into the record the amount, the cost that the utility incurs to serve each customer class. So residential ratepayers, commercial ratepayers, large industrial ratepayers, etc. Unfortunately, these class cost service studies are often ignored or discounted. For example, recently one customer class was required to pay 72% of a utility's rate increase despite the fact that the cost of service study suggested a far different result. These decisions impact investment and operation of businesses, some of whose cost of energy is 25% or more of the overall cost of production. Large industrial customers that I represent directly and or indirectly employ over 35,000 Minnesotans. Minnesota competes with other states and countries to retain these jobs. Minnesota is competing with Maine, Michigan, Canada, Australia, South America. The cost-based rates legislation that we're supporting will help keep the input costs of competitive, keep rate regulation transparent, and help Minnesota remain competitive. Legislation also encourages conservation and provides a platform to improve the penetration, efficiency, and stability of existing low-income programs. The legislation will not remove the Public Utilities Commission's discretion in setting rates. It will also not immediately increase the rates of other customers. We're continuing to work with parties on particular language regarding the low-income programs and ask that you support moving this bill out of the committee today. Happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions, Member? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gerber, does this bill just...
This is Mr. Moratska.
Oh, Mr. Moratska. Does this just shift the cost from businesses to residents?
No, it does not. The if it does anything, it removes an existing subsidy. And I would say that it's not just large industry. There are times when small businesses are also subsidizing other rate classes.
Hey, Representative.
I'm sorry, but thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I'm just, the answer of it removes a subsidy is a way of saying it shifts the cost of electricity amongst ratepayers. And I, Mr. Moratska, I appreciate you coming and representing your clients, these large energy users. And I just you know, we represent all sorts of different people, and I'm just curious if you've ever knocked on doors in a manufactured home park.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry, I missed the last part of your question.
In a manufactured home park, mobile home park, have you ever knocked on doors, talked to the people there?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, representative, I guess I'm not sure how the question pertains to the...
Well, Mr. Chair, probably not. Because it's not a, you know, politicians are those weird people who spend hours and hours every other year or every year knocking on doors and listening to people. And that informs a lot of what I do as a policymaker. And there's one experience, I represent four manufactured home parks in my district. And there's one, this woman, maybe in her mid-30s, she had these two sort of adorable five-year-old twin boys, maybe six. They were old enough to be in Scouts, so maybe they were six. And she's one of the handful of people that has cried at the door when talking about what she struggled with. And this gets back to Representative Beard's comments about energy costs and, you know, those 50 cents or a dollar, they do add up, and we do need to be cognizant of them. And we do need to be cognizant of who's paying for energy amongst different classes. And this woman, she's a single mom, two little twin boys. Two parts of her commentary, or what she told me, really stuck with me. One, that she was very thankful for those kids' grandparents because they were willing to pay their Boy Scout fees, which the Scouts don't charge a whole lot. It's like $15 a year. And she was very thankful that the grandparents were willing to pay that so they could have that experience. And she also talked about her energy bills and being concerned about her power being shut off. And I appreciate that you have a low-income affordability program study in here. But removing what you call a subsidy, what I think one of the members called shifting the costs around, we're talking about shifting costs onto people like this woman who are just struggling to get by and trying really hard to raise their kids well, thankful that those kids have grandparents who are willing to pay $15 a year so they can be in Scouts. And the bill changes it's effective the day following final enactment. So this got signed into law. It could be effective next week or 2 weeks from now. And this study is supposed to come back February 1st, 2013. And, you know, the PUC process and rates, it'll take a while. But it just doesn't seem like a good balance to me to be potentially shifting these rates around and then just studying low-income affordability programs, which may or may not get funded, may or may not get passed. There's just a lot of questions, and I think we need to be really cognizant of that fact that for some people, their energy bills are about getting worried about getting things shut off. And that's definitely something I bring as someone who's knocked on a lot of doors and represents some people who do struggle with their energy bills and I just think members need to think about that a little bit as we talk about these large energy consumers and the different classes and how these rates might really impact people, real, you know, individuals on the ground trying to make their lives work. And so I just hope Mr. Maratska will think about that a little bit as he advocates for this bill, and as we go through the process, we need to make sure that the impacts on all the different groups of consumers are discussed and brought forward.
Representative Wiggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Maratska, you said as you were testifying that this wouldn't shift costs immediately. Can you give us the time frame when I can see my residents' utility rates go up? Representative Hackbarth can see his residents' utility rates go up, or Representative Scott can see utility rates per residence go up.
Mr. Bradford.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's difficult to say when rates would increase, because utilities have to come before the Public Utilities Commission to ask for a rate increase. They are presently in a period of investment due to federal and state renewable programs, emissions reduction programs, etc. And so a two-year time frame might be something reasonable, but I can't say anything for certain. And each time the utilities come before the commission, they file their class cost of service study, and each time it's a little different, and each time all the interveners go through and parse through that study.
Representative Wagenius.
So you're estimating that it would be a two-year time frame before Representative Hackbarth or Representative Scott or I would see a rate increase in our rates of our residents. Can you give me an estimate of the percentage increase costs that we would see?
Mr.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, I can't. I can't foresee what any of the utilities will be asking for in their next rate case.
Representative Wagenius.
Given that, how can you ask us to vote for a bill where we know we're going to see an increase in the rate of our residents, and we have no clue when we go back and we door knock and say, well, we just voted for a bill that's going to increase your electric rates, but I have no clue what the percentage increase will be. I can't do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the bill doesn't increase the rates. The companies that are investing and asking for cost recovery is what increases the rates. And the reason that we focus on cost is because these are regulated entities. So what we're trying to do in the theory of the regulation is that we're trying to mimic the market so that customers pay the cost of the good that they receive. So the cost of service study is something that Minnesota law requires to be filed to make sure that this regulation and that this market functions efficiently. And the benefit of the added benefit of making sure that the cost that the customer pays reflects the cost of service is, one, it sends the accurate price signals to the customer so that the customer knows how much it costs. That, in turn, will encourage conservation, which is one of our state's goals. Also, when the companies are paying, and the residential customers and all the other customers are paying the cost of the service, we keep rates for small business and big business competitive, and that's good for jobs, and those jobs then enable the people to pay for the utility rate increases.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess there's a lot of questions here, but first I'd ask Mr. Moratska, are any of your entities that you represent located in territories of not-for-profits, like are cooperatives?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Moratska, that's interesting to know. So you're dealing strictly with utilities that have a for-profit motive. And I'm just curious if you're all considered, if this is a major concern that the price of energy are too high, if you or your entities have considered lobbying for lower rates of return allowable by the regulated utilities. Have Have you or your clients asked for that type of idea to be considered?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes. In our utility rate cases, we retain experts and intervene and raise myriad issues, including rate of return, cost of equity, sales levels, revenue allocation, rate design, what have you. We participate on in a number of areas depending on the rate case and depending on what is being asked.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Moraski, it's basically your client's position that the rates of return allowable to the for-profit utilities are too high.
Mr. Moraski.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it depends on the case.
Well, you just said that you argue these things. I mean, I'm assuming you probably don't, or your clients don't argue that they want them to be higher, because that would mean that your rates would go up even further at the benefit of shareholders. But, I'm assuming your lobbying has been consistent that you felt the rates of return were too high, and so they should be lower, which would consequently lead to a lower cost of services. Would that be an accurate statement?
Right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm sorry if I was unclear. I tried to provide a range of the issues that we may pursue. It is expensive and time-consuming to participate in the rate-setting process, and so we don't always argue about rate of return, but sometimes we do. We don't always argue about rate design, but sometimes we do. It really depends on each case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I guess that gets back to the point that if we've got a fixed amount of return that a for-profit utility is allowed to earn, that's going to be divided up amongst different consumer, different rate payers. And so what this bill is advocating for, and I believe what your clients are advocating for, is that they should have to pay a lower proportionality of that allowable rate of return. And because that allowable rate of return is fixed, that means that some other group of ratepayers will have to pay a higher percentage, unless you're going to go and advocate for changing the rate of return, which would ultimately shrink the amount of money that would be allowable to be earned. It's just simple logic as far as I see it. And so this bill is advocating to raise the rates of people, consumers, ratepayers, at the benefit of a few select customers. And what you're saying is, I heard the comments about encouraging conservation. How on earth does this encourage conservation when you say to the largest industrial users that we want to go and allow you to have a lower cost so it is more profitable for you to either be less efficient, or if you continue your same efficiency but we lower your cost, it just makes you more profitable? I mean, the logic makes no sense. And finally, when we look at the incremental cost of providing each additional megawatt hour of energy, and we get in the loading queue, if we want to get into that whole discussion, we can, about how each additional megawatt hour gets more and more expensive, to go and supply that necessary power for some of these large users when they go through an expansion, it increases the cost for every consumer, because you have to pay for all of that infrastructure, and allow a rate of return is allowable over all of that infrastructure. And so for the average homeowner, or for the person that Representative Knuth talked about in a manufactured home park, if they were to even double their load demand for that facility, that home, the overall system impact is minimal. But when you start talking about system impacts by a large user, whether they're doubling their consumption, those impacts can be felt across the broadest swath of consumers possible. And so, sure, we should absolutely talk about that discussion about how much the incremental cost requires to be added to all consumers based on the needs of the very select few. Now, is all the generation being used all the time? Absolutely not. But that infrastructure has to be there and it has to be paid for. I can't vote for this. This is just going and saying, let's go and give another break, another incentive, another group, special preferential treatment, big businesses at the expense of real people.
Members, we're running short on time.
We've got a few more people that would like to speak. There's a couple of folks that we wanted to bring up from the audience yet. I don't know that we're going to get time to do that. Mr. Elwood with Legal Services Advocacy Project and Commissioner Grant. I don't know that we'll have time to bring those up with the people that we have with questions. I do want to state that this is my bill, and this is a work in progress. I've been working with the department on this since session began, before session began. Despite the high house file number that you see here, we've been working on this, and Commissioner Grant knows this. The department's been working with the department. The Department of Commerce has been, Minnesota Chamber of Commerce has been working with the Department of Commerce to try to work out the details of this bill. I've said from the very, very beginning when we brought this thing forward, this was originally Representative Beard's bill last year, and it did pass this body, and it did pass the Senate, and went to the governor, and the governor didn't like it, so now we're trying to work out the kinks and trying to make things work. The governor is meeting with some folks today, I believe, to work on this particular issue, and I think the commissioner could speak to that, that they are going to meet. But so this is something that we would like to get done. If we can work out the differences, particularly, and the commissioner knows this, that I and the department of, or the Chamber of Commerce knows this, I wanted to get the low income issue taken care of and straightened out in this bill, and I wanted that addressed, and they've been working hard to straighten that out. With that, members, I'm going to have Representative Beard have the last word, and we're probably going to have to adjourn.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, I'm on the list because I want a roll call. And I am going to move for a roll call on this amendment. And I am sorry you weren't going to recognize me, but we can get...
Representative Wiggin, yes. The amendment has been adopted, first of all. The A2 amendment has been adopted.
I did roll call, Mr. Chairman, on the bill.
Okay, you said the amendment.
Pardon?
Okay. I thought you said the amendment. You wanted a roll call on the amendment.
No, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I want a roll call on the bill because... our testifier has said that
Representative Wiginius, let me just cut to the chase. I don't think we're going to have time to hear the rest of the testimony from the people that wanted to testify. I don't think we're going to have time to vote on the bill, or we'll probably have to lay the bill over because we won't have time to take testimony from the other folks that want to testify.
Okay.
So we're running out of time, so we're probably going to lay the bill over. If that happens, we'll meet again another day if some of these things get worked out. So the point is, I'm going to lay the bill over.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, because otherwise I think a roll call would have been important so Minnesotans could know that this isn't just about the low-income folks. It's about raising rates on middle-income Minnesotans, and it will happen in about 2 years, according to the testifier.
Representative Wiginius? I brought you forward so you can speak to your issue about the roll call, etc. I wanted to clarify that we're probably going to lay the bill over. I was going to call on Representative Beard, who was next on the list. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you. I would have asked for a roll call on the bill anyhow, because this is, Representative Beard is exactly right. This is about middle-class Minnesota. It warms my heart, frankly, to hear the discussion that was just taking place on the other side of the table about the sudden concern for costs that we're putting on our low-income residents. Perhaps you'll join me in actually revisiting the cost of the renewable energy standard, the cost of integrating wind into the grid, the cost of the conservation program that is ostensibly supposed to help us save the cheapest power, the stuff we don't ever build. Maratska, you don't have to respond to this. I'm just going to make this comment, and if I'm off base, someone can correct me. First of all, I had United Steelworkers in my office when I carried this bill last year, members, saying the cost of complying with some of this stuff that we've done has cost them 15 vacancies at the Rock 10 plant. Now, I have a hunch that maybe the father of those twins that we just heard about may not have a job, because there are 15 vacancies. And oh, by the way, they start at north of $55,000 a year. Those vacancies are being held open because of the cost of complying with the mandates we've put on their electrical energy use, as if they're not interested in being as efficient as they already possibly can, because the Rock 10 plant is a very precarious position when it comes to the cardboard industry in the entire North American continent. We're very grateful that those folks have made an effort to stay here and keep, Mr. Maratska, what is it, 600 or 700 jobs down there? But just so you know, there's 15 USW jobs standing vacant right now because of these costs. And those are people who could be paying electric bills in the mobile home parks, and I have two of them in the district I represent. I do knock on those doors. I do hear these things. And sometimes they ask, what are we doing up here? The cost of some of the things we've applied actually do add up. It's those little pennies and so on that add up across the spectrum to the folks in the mobile home parks. They do. But where they really add up are the people who buy electricity from their own substations, folks. That's why I think this bill is so important, that we actually quantify the cost of delivering that power to people who do really big things, like, oh, let's say make steel in Inver Grove Heights or South St. Paul, or refine crude oil, or make ethanol, or take your pick, places that employ hundreds of people at a time, have their own substation, and have to have a rate that's actually based somewhat on the cost of delivering the service, so those people can actually have good paying jobs and pay their own electric bill without having to come running to the government for a handout to help heal some of the mischief we've afflicted. Mr. Chairman, I think the bill asks for very reasonable things, which is that the cost of supplying the service be one of the things that's considered whenever we're setting rates, because the people who actually buy lots of power actually employ real people in the private sector and make this economy as prosperous as we can. Thank you for laying the bill over so we can consider this further and for the chance just to make a few comments.
Thank you, Representative Beard. And Mr. Grant, please work with the governor and the folks that are coming in to that meeting. Hopefully we can come to a conclusion and an agreement, and we can pass this bill on a bipartisan basis. Members, I'm afraid we're out of time, and I will lay House File 2769 over for possibly bringing it up at another time, maybe even Friday morning, Representative Dill.
Yep.
Meeting adjourned.